third oral argument of the day, which is in the matter of the professional engineer license of Charles Mehron. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument, with an additional 5 minutes to relator's counsel if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep an audio recording of the proceedings. And this way, the public can keep track of who's attached to which argument. The timing restrictions are indicated in the middle podium. There's a light. There's also a clock. The green light indicates you've got time available. Yellow light indicates you're within 5 minutes of your concluding. And the red light, by the time the red light comes on, you should have stopped. You'll note there are three different lecterns. You can choose which of the two closest to you to use. If you're concerned for health reasons and prefer to use the microphone closest to your desk, you certainly may. Otherwise, you're free to use the middle podium, entirely up to you. With that, counsel for appellant, whenever you are ready to proceed, or counsel for the relator, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
So I'd like to say, before I get into my time, about 9 years ago, I lost my hearing in my left ear. You see this thing up here, it's a cochlear implant. It helps a little bit. But if the court interrupts me in the middle of argument, I can't hear two people speaking at once, even if I'm one of them speaking.
Understood.
So I may ask you to repeat yourselves.
Thank you for clarifying that. And is the audio loud enough in the room? We can turn the microphone. Can we adjust the speaker and the testing? 1, 2, 3. Tell me if that is any better.
A little bit better.
All right. Thank you. And let us know anytime during the argument, if you're having difficulty hearing, just raise your hand and we'll do what we can to accommodate. Thank you.
Thank you.
You may choose the lectern and begin your argument when you're ready.
Great.
And we'll try not to talk over you too much so that we don't create any problems with your ability to hear us.
May it please the court, my name is William Moorman, and I represent the relator, Charles Mehron. I wanted to start my argument out this morning by addressing three facts that are not in dispute. Fact number one is the state does not dispute that my client, Charles Mehron, hasn't worked as a professional engineer since 2012. Two, the state fully admits that when Mr. Mehron referred to himself as a professional engineer during the period he was unlicensed, it was while he was engaged in political advocacy, and actually is political advocacy that is damaging to the business interests of engineers. And number three, none of the board's allegations in the case involve Mr. Mehron practicing as an engineer. In other words, there's no allegations here that Mr. Mehron was involved in building a bridge that was going to collapse or endanger the public. That's not what's going on in this case. The appeal here today is from a decision by the Minnesota Board of Professional Engineers to sanction Mr. Mehron because he referred to himself as a professional engineer during a two-year period where Mr. Mehron forgot to renew his two-year license as a professional engineer from 2018 to 2020. MnStat Section 326.02, Subdivision 3B, prohibits anyone in the state from identifying themselves as a professional engineer unless they have a professional engineering license. That's what the statute says. So, for instance, if one of you judges went home tonight and said to your spouse, whoever you're living with, I'm a professional engineer, according to the state, you'd be violating the statute, because the statute is that kind of bold, if you will. This case got started because, as I said earlier, Mr. Mehron's not practicing.
Now, that would be...
What's that?
Even though you said it would be, you know, the state's position, and that's a bold look at the statute, that would be a plain reading application of the statute, though, also, correct?
Yep. Yeah, it would be. Yeah. There's no qualification in the statute about that. With the one caveat, when you look at, I think it's 326.01, which describes the purpose of the statute and the like. It says the purpose is to protect the public, basically, from engineers doing bad engineering projects, which we would argue provides interpretive support for our position in this case regarding that provision. So Mr. Mehron quit practicing as a professional engineer in 2012 to start a nonprofit called Strong Towns that he's an employee of. Strong Towns' purpose is basically to advocate against massive public engineering projects. So Mr. Marone doesn't have a lot of friends in the professional engineering world because his organization has been successful in convincing state, county, and municipal governments not to go forward with massive public works projects that would inure to the economic benefit of engineers around the country. And in fact, that's how this case got started, because a engineer in South Dakota by the name of David Dixon filed a complaint with the Minnesota Board of Professional Engineers that Mr. Marone had the audacity at these public advocacy conferences he was at to say he was a professional engineer during the time he was unlicensed. And that's what Mr. Dixon's complaint was about. We also noted in our facts, when the board was investigating this matter through its complaint committee, there was a meeting that Mr. Marone had with his prior counsel where the board members were saying, well, we're really disturbed about this. You're actually talking about being a professional engineer at these at these public advocacy conferences. I will tell the court that, I think the state said this in their papers, we commenced a federal court action before the state filed this case to get a pre-enforcement ruling that the state's interpretation of the statute violates the First Amendment, as we've laid out in our papers here. Federal District Court dismissed that case because the state subsequently commenced this disciplinary proceeding, and under the anti-injunction doctrine and the Younger doctrine, the federal court had to stay its hands, so the case was dismissed without prejudice. I'll tell the court that the statements that were made by these complaint committee board members would give rise to a First Amendment retaliation claim. And to complain that Mr. Marone was describing himself as a professional engineer while engaged in political speech, at a minimum, I think gives rise to a claim, and I think a successful claim. The last thing I wanted to...
Could a person under protection of the First Amendment misrepresent himself as a police officer? Could the person be charged with the crime of impersonating a police officer by falsely representing himself as a police officer during a political event?
No.
Is that a First Amendment? Why isn't that protected under the First Amendment, but this would be?
That gets right to Alvarez. So I at the end of our brief, we went through, because they're claiming that Mr. Marone lied in his reinstatement application. The U.S. Supreme Court in the Alvarez case, I think it was decided about 8 years ago. Prior to the Alvarez case, it was unknown whether First Amendment free speech protection extends to just outright lying. And what the Alvarez case involved was a political candidate who was running for office saying he won the Congressional Medal of Honor. And Congress had passed a statute called the Stolen Valor Act saying you can't go and lie about winning the Congressional Medal of Honor. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, nope, First Amendment applies, First Amendment free speech guarantee applies to lying. And in that case, you have to, the state still, or the government would still have to show it had a compelling interest to enforce in those circumstances the fact that this gentleman was lying about having received the Congressional Medal of Honor. One of the things the Supreme Court said in that case is it was an opinion by Justice Kennedy, and he laid out alternatives that the government could do. One of the things Kennedy said is, look, this is the age of the internet. You can solve this really easily. Why doesn't the Defense Department put on its website who's won the Congressional Medal of Honor? And then if somebody's lying about it, people can go on the internet and they can figure that out.
Right, but unlike a Congressional Medal of Honor, I mean, a law enforcement license and an engineer's license, I think, are separate, aren't they? I mean, I thought you were acknowledging that a person could not misrepresent himself, could not rely upon the First Amendment to assert as protected speech misrepresentation of licensure as a peace officer.
Yes. So I.
And if so,
So let me get to that example.
Okay.
My first kind of off the cuff response to come back at you was, depends when the police officer's saying it. If he's saying it on a date to impress the person he wants, he's on the date with? No, I don't think that can be enforced because there's no interest there. If the police officer is saying that at a, or the person, right, because it's false, right? If the person's saying that at a political event, the answer is no. I mean, let's just think about it. I mean, the worst thing would be, I would think, it'd be somebody representing they're a police officer when they're running for public office. I don't see how that's distinguishable from the Stolen Valor Act. So one quote I wanted to give you.
Can I just ask you, what about a situation where political speech and commercial speech are overlapping? Which I think is kind of what the board is arguing here, maybe indirectly, that this is commercial speech, even if it may have had a political component. But just go with me for the purpose of this argument. What if it has overlapping purposes? What sort of First Amendment protection is there?
The political speech will override the commercial speech. I will tell you that I was shocked when I got the commercial speech argument from the state. I do a lot of First Amendment free speech work. I was like stunned. Commercial speech is when you're proposing a commercial transaction. There's no commercial transaction here that Mr. Marone was proposing with anyone. And I actually would ask Your Honor, just sitting here, I can't think of a situation where those two things would intertwine. Unless you're going to go to the point of arguing that a political candidate falsely represented they were a police officer, right? And you're saying it's commercial speech because if they won the election, they're going to draw a salary from being a congressman. That doesn't fly. That's not commercial speech. That's commercial speech is limited to speech in the commercial arena. I'm not even sure you could say we got commercial speech here with Mr. Marone because he's, first of all, it's not that Mr. Marone was doing this self for himself individually, like, you know, he owned his own business. He works for Strong Towns. It's a nonprofit. It has 18 employees.
But Mr. Mormon,
yes.
Sorry, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
He put the information that he was a professional engineer on flyers, on a book jacket, on various things that he wanted people to purchase or wanted people to attend. And so explain how that isn't commercial speech.
Because he was putting that on it. The commercial speech doctrine, you have to be proposing a transaction. You have to be proposing a transaction. The book is not proposing a transaction. I fortunately was able to locate a federal court decision, oddly enough, out of the Minnesota District Court here, the Dreyer case, where some former professional football players were suing the NFL over NFL film productions of, you know, NFL films will do things of, you know, Super Bowl 19 or, you know, the greatest running backs or whatever. And these people sued saying you're using our likeness in the films. And it was Judge Paul Magnuson in his decision. The league came back and said, no, there's First Amendment implications here. And Judge Magnuson bought the argument, and he went through an analysis of the commercial speech factors and said, you know, first of all, it has to be in advertising. And he said the product itself is not advertising. So that's kind of what you're arguing here, where he's saying in a book, that's it's a book, it's not an advertisement. It also then has the use of the speech has to refer to the product that's being proposed for the transaction. Mr. Marone is not doing that because the book is the book. It's the same thing.
He wants people to buy the book, though, doesn't he?
That gets to the third argument that Judge Magnuson laid out, which is the economic motivation. Judge Magnuson just said everybody who writes a book wants to sell it. That does not mean it's economic
but
motivation.
Doesn't the use of PE or identifying himself as a professional engineer make it more likely that people will want to buy the book based on that fact alone? Isn't that why he put it on there?
He put it... No, he didn't put it on there, I think, to get him to buy the book. I think he put it on there to bolster his credentials, to bolster his political argument. that when he's making the argument that governments are wasting funds on public engineering projects, you can trust what I'm saying because I'm a trained engineer, which is actually accurate.
So why not just say engineer instead of professional engineer?
I think because that, you know, that's what he had done his whole life, is referred to himself as a professional engineer. He wasn't aware that his license had lapsed when this happened. So
are you saying that his lack of awareness that the license had lapsed is an excuse for continuing to use the title?
No, my main argument is that the state doesn't have an interest in policing his use of using the term professional engineer in the context of political speech. That, you know, I haven't really gotten into that legal argument, but one is, my first argument was a matter of statutory interpretation under the Weatherston case, where the Minnesota Supreme Court has interpreted this specific statute, not dealing with the title of professional engineers, but the actual statute in 1960, and they said that this should not be interpreted by its literal meaning, but consistent with its purpose, which is to regulate professional engineers when they're practicing engineering. And my second legal argument is if the court doesn't do that, then we've got a huge First Amendment problem. Because then the state has to establish a compelling interest, that they have a compelling interest to prohibit Mr. Marone from describing himself as a professional engineer when he's engaged in political advocacy. And I don't see how they can possibly make that argument. The court indicated, they're trying to get around it with commercial speech, but the problem is they still have to establish a substantial interest in regulating commercial speech, and I don't see any interest that they would have in regulating this speech other than they want to stop Mr. Marone from speaking. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Pen here. May it please the court, my name is Assistant Attorney General Alan Cook Barr, here today on behalf of the respondent, Minnesota Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design. The court should affirm in this case because relator Charles Marone has no First Amendment right to lie about his licensure status and no First Amendment right to give false information on license renewal applications. The board disciplined Mr. Marone because he held himself out as a professional engineer online, in presentations, and in print when he was not, in fact, a licensed professional engineer, and then he denied doing so on his license renewal applications. Mr. Marone admits to the conduct in question, but argues he had a First Amendment right to engage in it. He doesn't because there are three reasons why his false claims of licensure are not protected by the First Amendment. First, false licensure claims are not protected. Second, false commercial speech is not protected. And third, false statements for material gain are not protected. Any one of those three theories would justify discipline in this case.
If you could start with the question that Judge Gaitis asked, which is when you have a situation where arguably the speech is both potentially political in some aspects and commercial in other aspects, how do you propose we address that? How are we supposed to decide what to apply?
You follow Fox, Your Honor, the Tupperware case out of New York where the individuals were engaging in Tupperware sales in dorm rooms. That case, the court held that there was no law of man or nature that prohibited people from engaging in the protected speech without engaging in the unprotected speech or vice versa. So if you can split them up, then the court has to do so under Fox, and the state can take action on the unprotected speech. In this case, nothing prevented Mr. Marone from engaging in his political advocacy without first identifying himself as a professional engineer. He could have said, I'm Charles Marone, and I think that cities should spend more money fixing potholes and less on exorbitant bus projects or whatever he wants to critique. He did not need to say he was a professional engineer before engaging in the protected speech. And so because the court can parse that out under Fox, it has to.
Isn't the apparent intent of the statute to protect the public from individuals who are not properly licensed as professional engineers from engaging individuals to do the work?
Yes, I think that's right, Your Honor.
Isn't this sort of an overbroad application of the statute then?
No, so and get into this sort of in our history of licensing statutes. It's not enough. The state's interest isn't just saying, okay, once you've done work you shouldn't have done, we're going to go after you. We want to stop the work from being done in the first place.
Not just work from being done. Let's say it goes further, soliciting work. There's no indication that the speech involved here it was soliciting work as a professional engineer, was there?
Specific projects, no. However, the speech on its own, if you just said Charles Marone, professional engineer, which is effectively the speech here, that would lead the public to believe that they could hire Mr. Marone to perform professional engineering work. If you look back at the statutes that predate the Constitution, those, and that at the time was medical practice, that was really the first trade that was regulated in the United States. Those statutes didn't just say you can't do medical work. They didn't just say you can't solicit medical work. They went further and said you cannot even hold yourself out as being capable of doing medical work unless you have the license from New York City, the license from New Jersey, the qualification from Connecticut. And this is then an outgrowth of that just in professional engineering rather than in the medical field. This gets to the first reason why discipline is consistent with the First Amendment. There's a long and historical tradition of states being able to regulate professional trades and licensing claims. In Alvarez, the Supreme Court recognized that strict scrutiny was not required if there was a tradition of the state regulating speech in question, and there is here. Even before the Constitution was adopted, states were regulating professional trades and prohibiting people from using titles, using qualifications given by the state, unless people actually had those qualifications.
Does the state acknowledge that there would be some circumstances in which application of this statute would be unconstitutional under the First Amendment?
B1 just says you can't use the phrase professional engineer.
Right.
So I'm using that phrase right now.
Right.
And certainly, I don't think that it would, and the board does not think that our discussion now is in violation of the statute.
Court security will be waiting for you.
I think the statute has to be read in light of B2 and B3. Those two both say you have to make the statement to lead the public to believe you are, in fact, a professional engineer.
So it sounds like you're agreeing that the statute does implicate protected speech.
Yes, it's a content-based restriction. However, it does not implicate the First Amendment in this case because of the tradition of licensure laws that predates the Constitution, and that was not changed when the Constitution was adopted. If you look at those laws that were pre-Constitution, they continued to be enforced after the Constitution was adopted. It wasn't until the 1820s when there started to be some deregulation, but that wasn't due to constitutional litigation. I've searched, I have not found any cases challenging licensure laws pre-Alvarez. The only two that I'm aware of post-Alvarez are Jarlstrom and Serafine, which I'll get to in a couple minutes here. But the history of licensure laws indicates an unbroken tradition from pre-First Amendment through the adoption of the Constitution, through modern times of states being able to prohibit individuals from holding themselves out as having a professional qualification when they do not, in fact, have that qualification.
Could we decide this appeal solely on the false license application basis and not get at the other issues, or do we need to get it all?
I believe you could resolve it solely on the false license application piece. So the board imposed a $1,500 civil penalty and censured and reprimanded him. Even if the court doesn't reach the holding out piece, those violations alone would be sufficient for a censured and reprimanded and $1,500 civil penalty. So no, the court does not, strictly speaking, need to reach both issues. Either would be sufficient. Do want to briefly address Serafina Jarlstrom before going on to the other two pieces. So with respect to Serafina being post-Alvarez and throwing into doubt, or at least according to relators, throwing into doubt whether or not the state can regulate professional titles, Serafina was solely a commercial speech case. That in that case, the state didn't raise the issue or look at any of the history of past practice of license regulation. Similarly, in Jarlstrom, that wasn't really a case about falsehoods. In Jarlstrom, it was a case about a statute being overbroad. Oregon prohibited the use of the term engineer, period. It covered train engineers. It covered civil engineers. It covered a wide variety of things that weren't subject to licensure. Here, professional engineers, we lay out in our brief, is a recognized term in the industry as someone with a license from the state to do professional engineering. The second alternative reason for why Mr. Moran's false statements of licensure aren't protected is the commercial speech doctrine. It is clear that false or misleading commercial speech has no First Amendment value and may be prohibited. Multiple circuits, multiple states, as we said in a brief, have applied the commercial speech doctrine to hold that the use of a professional title constitutes commercial speech and can be prohibited. Mr. Marone argues that it has to propose a transaction. While that is a relevant consideration, that is not the test. If you look at Central Hudson, there was no transaction proposed. If you look at Bulger, there was no transaction proposed. If you look at Friedman, there was no concrete transaction proposed. At best, Friedman stands for the proposition, which we agree with, that the use of the title alone can come to be an offer for goods or services. There was, I don't remember the company, I will say sunglasses, because it was some sort of eyeglass company. And that name alone suggested that you could go there and you could buy eyeglasses, you could get visual services. Similarly, in this case, Mr. Marone's use of the title professional engineer alone suggests that you can go to Mr. Marone and you can get professional engineering services. Now, Mr. Marone has argued throughout this case that if someone actually went to him and tried to get professional engineering services done, he doesn't do them anymore. And while that may be the case, members of the public going to him wouldn't know that until they reached out to him. He is still holding out as a professional engineer by the use of the title, even if he ultimately wouldn't perform the services if someone tried to hire them. That's important because the state's interest, as we've discussed, is not just stopping people once they contract from doing professional engineering services. It's stopping the potential from contracts happening in the first place.
So it's just so that I'm clear, your position is that it becomes commercial speech just by virtue of saying, I'm a professional engineer.
Yes, I think unless it's clear you're in a theater play or you're on, you know, unless it's apparent it's false so that the public wouldn't actually believe you're a professional engineer, yes.
What if you're on a date?
You're on a date? Yeah, I think that would still be, yes, you're leading a member to the public to believe it. Now, that's not what happened here, certainly, Your Honor. Here
I'm just trying to get an understanding of the extent to which you're... So if I understand your acknowledgement earlier that the First Amendment is implicated, I gather then it's only in the circumstances under a paragraph A where you use the term, but you're not referring to yourself.
That, yes.
So even in private conversation,
In private conversations, if you lead a member of the public to believe you're a professional engineer, it's the board's position that would violate the statute. The line the board is drawing is
and just simply because that member of the public might mistakenly think they can retain your services.
Exactly. If I make the statement, but it's the member of the public wouldn't think they could hire me, then it's a different issue. But here,
but you're saying it doesn't even matter whether the public could hire you. I mean, what if Fred is sitting by his mother on her deathbed? She's always wanted Fred to be an engineer. Fred, it's never been an engineer, but he wants to impress. He wants mom to believe, you know, this is my last conversation with mom. She's about to go out. She's on her deathbed. Mom, I did it. I'm a professional engineer. Your view is that's a problem under the statute. You can enforce this provision against that individual.
Yes, I think you could. I will say it. I don't see the board doing so, but in terms of exercising discretion, not. But no, I think.
But no First Amendment protection at all.
No. You've held out to Mrs. Fred, and she has said, and she now believes that her son is a professional engineer when he isn't, and it's clear under the history of licensure enforcement laws that is a permissible imposition of discipline under the First Amendment.
Counsel, you have not very much time left here, with just about a minute. In your brief, you disagree with your opposing counsel that the Dick Weatherston case is actually a case that's on point. If that's true, then are there any cases on point here in Minnesota? And if there are not, then is this a decision that ultimately should be made precedential?
Yes, sir. I think this decision should be made precedential. Outside of Dick Weatherston, I'm not aware of any case in Minnesota interpreting 326 at all. Certainly not in the time that I've represented this board has there been any.
And so if that's the case, then do you have a proposed syllabus point for us to consider?
Certainly. So with respect to the statutory piece, it would be that a person violates 326.02 when the individual holds themselves out in a manner that leads a member of the public to believe they are a professional engineer. With respect to the First Amendment piece, it would be that individuals have no First Amendment right to falsely represent their credentials to the public as a licensee when they are not licensed.
Thank you.
As to the court, affirm the board's order. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for relator, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Sorry, what's that?
You have 5 minutes of rebuttal time, sorry.
Well, that was interesting. From my perspective, my case just got a lot better.
And if you could, just for the record again, restate your name.
I'm sorry. I'm William Mormon, representing Relator Charles Marone.
Thank you.
So Mr. Barr admitted that the statute, the plain meaning, doesn't really apply, that there's a line to be drawn. What he really didn't get at, well, kind of got at it, but really doesn't get at is where do you draw that line?
Well, I think he said the line, that the plain meaning applies, oh, I see, except for provision, the first provision. He acknowledged that. You are correct.
Yeah. I wrote that down. It wouldn't be a violation all the time. Well, where do you draw the line? Where I recommend you draw the line is when someone's engaged in providing engineering services or offering to provide engineering services. That's where the line gets drawn. I want to quote for you from Weatherston again.
What about, I'm just going to interrupt you. What about when, as in this case, offering opinions about engineering? I mean, that seems a little closer of a call than the situation, you know, where you have a professional actor making that utterance, or in the case of Judge Ross's.
I get what you're saying.
Hypothetical, yeah.
Yeah, so the problem is you're not engaged in engineering. So you're offering opinions on engineering in conjunction with political speech. The political speech is going to override whatever concerns you have about engineering in that circumstance, because you run into this huge problem that the state is going to use this provision as a stalking horse to squelch my client from engaging in political advocacy, which is against the economic interests of professional engineers. That's the problem with that. So your question also gets to the second point, which is the state says that they have an interest, actually, in having the public not being deceived about whether somebody is a professional engineer, even though they're not going to hire the person as a professional engineer. That's absurd. They do not have an interest in that. They don't have a compelling one. They don't have a substantial one. They don't even have a legitimate one. In fact, I was going to read Weatherston, but I'll jump ahead to the Lowe versus SEC case where the Supreme Court was adhering to the professional speech doctrine before NIFLA. This is in Justice White's opinion. He said, where the personal nexus between the professional and the client does not exist, and a speaker does not purport to be exercising judgment on behalf of any particular individual with those circumstances he is directly acquainted, government regulation ceases to function as legitimate regulation of professional practice with only incidental impact on speech. It becomes regulation of speaking or publishing as such, subject to the First Amendment's command that, as I put it, the five most beautiful languages in our Constitution, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech.
Can I turn you to what, in the
sure.
few moments remaining, to what, at least to me, seems to be the weakest part of your case, which is the false application claim.
Right.
That seems to have the least protection, or the First Amendment seems to be furthest removed from that. And address that if you could.
Sure. I'll get to that real quickly. So I want to say before I move on, you can avoid all the constitutional stuff if you apply Weatherston. If you say Weatherston, and you know the quote from that says, you're not to apply these statutes that literally to lead to absurd results. And by the way, under Minnesota's statute.
Except to the false representation, the false.
I'll get to that.
Right.
I'll get to that.
I'm just saying Weatherston doesn't, that seems to be, First Amendment, Weatherston, that all seems to be separate from this.
I don't think it is, because if the state doesn't have an interest in prohibiting Mr. Marone from saying he's a professional engineer outside of practicing engineering, then how does the state have an interest in asking him whether he used the term professional engineer outside the practice of engineering?
Well, it seems to me you'd have an interest to say, well, have you ever represented yourself as a professional engineer, yes or no? If the answer is yes, explain. And then you could give your First Amendment explanation, but in this case, just simple dishonesty, if it is dishonesty.
I don't think it is. It's compelled speech. So you're compelling, it's compelled speech, which is subject to the First Amendment free speech guarantee. You're compelling Mr. Marone to answer that question. The state still has to have an interest in forcing him to answer that question. What's the state's interest in having him answer that question if it's not connected to the profession?
Well, he was applying to have his licensure reinstated. So they do have an interest because he was asking for them to license him.
I completely disagree with that. They do not have an interest in knowing whether he called himself a professional engineer if it wasn't connected to the practice of engineering.
Don't they have an interest in exploring whether his representations to the public were, let's assume you're correct, let's assume we agree completely with all the rest of your argument that he's got a, that this statute should be applied only in the context of soliciting work or holding yourself out to the public so as not to mislead, et cetera, wouldn't the state have an interest in exploring whether he's crossed the line in his representations by asking the question, have you ever represented yourself as an engineer during the time that you weren't allowed to?
I would say that I would go back to saying no, because they don't have an interest, number one. And number two, if that's what the state's position is, then the state should make that clear in the question on the application. Mr. Marone testified in his declaration that when he read that question, he assumed it meant that he was representing him as a professional engineer when engaged in professional engineering. I hope the court understands Mr. Marone was not aware of the complaint against him by Mr. Dixon until after he had made that applied for reinstatement. So he didn't know this could possibly be an issue. And he testified in his declaration, if he knew that, if he had received Dixon's complaint, then he would have answered that question. Oh, I probably have to explain this to the board. I don't want to get any more trouble. But when he answered the question, he looked at it, no, I haven't said I'm a professional engineer. I haven't been doing professional engineering services. I'm getting a flashing red light here.
Yes, I think you are.
If there's additional questions.
Thank you. I believe that we've exhausted ourselves of both time and questions.
Great.
So thank you both for your excellent argument, both in brief and in your oral advocacy today. I've said it once before, I don't always say this, but your clients should both be very happy with the representation that you've provided. So thank you both. The court appreciates it.
By the way, it's great to be back in court again.
Isn't it nice to be live again? We think so, too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon.